And now I am here in the Marquee Media Studios with Bert Spencer. He's the CTO of Traitwear, and he is with his son, the CEO and CMO of Traitwear. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great, Mark. Thanks for having us.
I appreciate you being here. I ran into your dad as I was out in Nevada City one day, or Grass Valley.
And you were at the Tech Hub, Nevada County Tech Hub, which is similar to your space there. But and not quite as well financed, I think.
Well, I started hearing about your business, and then the first thing you did was start talking about your new CEO. I don't know if he was new, but the CEO that you recruited, which was your son. So it's turned out to be a family business. Is that right?
Well, in a way, it has. There's been several family members. One of my friends was also a partner in starting the company. His son played a key role in developing some of the technology, and he's a developer, and but now we brought in the marketing guy and the.
Heath was telling me that you are the mad scientist and he's the CEO marketing guy. So give us the story of what Traitwear is, how you started it, and then where we are today, just so we have an overview.
So I actually played a key role in starting it. We had actually been in the security space, had started another company. Unfortunately, we had a CEO that got leukemia and pneumonia at the same time and passed away. And we had to do a pivot. And fortunately, we had insurance, key man insurance, and we were able to decide whether we were just going to turn the money back or start again, and decided, sat around a table in San Francisco at a board meeting and asked the question, what do you need in the security space? And so I asked that question, and it went around. There were five of us there, and all of us decided we had a problem in the security space with passwords and usernames.
Right.
And decided we needed to solve that problem. Had no concept how we were going to do it at the time. At the time, biometrics on the phone were just starting to take place. I had an Atrix phone that had a fingerprint reader on it, and for a long time, I didn't even use it. Actually, I sat down at a birthday party with another guy that had one. He showed it to me. I said, that is cool. I set up my phone and started using it. And from there, we started creating Traitwear. And we didn't have enough phones that really had biometrics time. We had to create another way to do it. But the basis of using a phone as a token so we could go passwordless started out of that and started the way that we actually now have a technology that we can eliminate usernames and password credentials.
So no usernames and passwords. What a concept. Heath, you joined the company when?
So I actually joined the company part-time about 3 years ago. I was still running another business that I had founded and built up over time, and through that business had built some relationships within the Bay Area tech scene and some other enterprise space relationships. And so as the technology started to really come to fruition, I kind of took the technology and went to some of my relationships and said, hey, what do we really have here? And is this something that's really viable? One of those connections was with one of the big consulting firms. And based on that relationship, we got an introduction to their IT and security department. We flew to Nashville to meet with them. And coming out of that meeting, basically said, this is amazing technology that you've created, but you're literally on the bloody edge of it. Mm-hmm. So you need to figure out how do you find, an audience of early adopters, and then, find this many users across this much space for this much time, and then, get off the bloody edge and get onto the bleeding edge of this type of technology. Bert alluded to this, that really it wasn't until recent years that true passwordless authentication could actually be deployed, because modern technology has recently allowed for that type of technology to come into play. A crazy fact that a lot of people don't maybe know is that the password was actually born in 1961 at MIT.
Hmm.
The crazy part of that story is, and this is actually an article that we have up on our website, is this kind of the history of the password, right? Is that within 5 months of the password being born, they had their first incident of credential misuse, right? So the reason the password was born is in 1961, as you can imagine, back then at MIT, they basically had one mainframe computer, right? So you got all these grad, PhD students, grad students that are vying for server time, right, computer time on this mainframe. So one of the professors basically said, okay, I need a way to regulate this server time and then account for its use and all of this, and then I can give each student an hour or 2 hours or whatever it is, right? So the username, the legacy login we know today of username and password was created at MIT.
Interesting.
5 months later, now you have to imagine these are MIT students. They're pretty bright, right?
Yeah.
One of the PhD students noticed that the list of credentials was saved in the computer, right?
Yes.
So while he's in there, he said, I'll just print that and I can then have more server time, right? So within 5 months of the password being born in 1961, you had credential misuse, yeah, right?
Defeated.
So they've been trying to solve this problem since 1961. And again, going back to until now, right, until there was modern technology, we really weren't able to solve it in a way that really eliminated it without having to use just layers of security on top of the legacy login, right? So we've seen over the last decade or so, other solutions work to just add more security to that broken legacy login.
So how? So you have your product, it works on a phone or it works on a desktop computer?
So we can work across device.
Okay.
But the primary way we achieve passwordless authentication and what we had our first patent issued on is the way that we tokenize your mobile device to become a secure token, right? So if you look at the definition of multi-factor authentication, it is something that you have or something you are, something that you know, right? So it's one, it's, it has to be a minimum of two of those three variations, right? Then there's other factors you can add to create more security like geofence or things like that, right? So to have multi-factor authentication or a way to log into a solution without having to use username or password credentials is to have a secure token. So ways that this was being done previously and actually has been done for a long time now, you've probably been into buildings that use a secure CAC card, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a secure token that you carry around, and then essentially your identity profile is tied to that card, right? Trying to use, now that's very prevalent for building access,
mm-hmm.
right? They have levered that into adding multi-factor to your laptop or your desktop, but it then required buying other hardware, right? A way to read that card or to way to interface with that card, right? And then we've seen the advancement of YubiKey or Google's Titan Key for a FIDO process where it's another secure token that you possess, right? So it's something you have. Bert and the team looked at, you know, what is something we're already carrying around so that we don't have to buy another device, right? And another piece of hardware that either gets lost or left in the machine or something like that, or that we've got to replace all the time. You know, so our smartphones, right, we're already carrying it on a daily basis.
You bet.
You know, most people today, and this is not our study, but other people's studies, won't leave their house, right? They actually won't be more than 3 feet away from their mobile device at any given time. You know, mine's sitting right next to me.
Yeah, mine's,
right?
mine's over my desk. Shoot.
Right.
Yeah, we carry them around.
You carry it around with you, right?
Even Bert's got the cell phone, smartphone.
Yeah, well,
right.
I have to. It's
so
my key.
It's something that you're already carrying. So they looked at that and said, okay, this is a technology that has advancements in modern use, right? That we should be able to leverage and create a new way of doing things with it. We've seen a proliferation of apps that come out on your mobile device for all types of things, from fitness to whatever it is, right?
You bet.
How do we use that simplicity to improve your interaction with devices? So at a baseline, we need the mobile device. Now, whether you choose to register your phone or a tablet, is up to you. We recommend one device for security reasons because you'll notice when one device is missing, right? You'll notice if your phone is missing, hey, my security token's missing.
So your phone is your security token.
That becomes your token, and that's our proprietary secret sauce, is what we've got our first patent issued on. We just got our second one allowed 10 days ago?
Oh, I don't know what exactly. It's been allowed. We got notice it was allowed a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so
we've got 10 other patents.
So we turned this into the something that you have, similar to going back to that security cat card.
So walk me through this, just a C student here. So Bert, why don't you walk me through this? You got the your phone, and yeah. I want to do what with it? And I need a
phone, and you asked the question, can you sign in both from the device or onto a PC? So we've got two different modes. One of the things that's unique about Traitware is we actually have what we call our direct login method that lets us sign in directly from the device. So if I want to sign in the device, I just go to my Traitware app.
Oh, go to Traitware app, okay.
And I click the account that I want. It takes a trace of my face. Mm-hmm. It verifies that biometric. And all of that process, it talks to the authentication server. It verifies that the app was one that was previously registered for that account. Mm-hmm. And then I can just click one button on a phone, and I pulled up my SSO that lets me sign into G Suites, Google, a whole bunch of different things.
How is that different than like LastPass or some of those?
Because there's no password involved here. LastPass, okay. You're pulling up a password. You can stuff it. Somebody can still steal that credential. They can still have to put it in. And here, that password doesn't exist. It's the actual characteristics of the phone and the traits of the phone and a bunch of private character keys.
So I'm going to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah.
We can't go into the full engineering depth in this conversation of how that process takes place. But a big differentiator in what Traitware is doing is we're creating a tokenized payload of your identity through authentication standards such as OpenID Connect or SAML 2.0, which are a way for technologies, service providers, or applications to allow for this mathematical representation of who you are to integrate with their service, right? So any application that's out there, you know, Bert mentioned a few, so whether it's Salesforce or Office 365 or, you know, typical cloud SaaS apps, beyond that, you know, physical boxes were on the precipice of deploying to physical signing into your actual computer, et cetera. A big difference is that, so you mentioned LastPass, that's essentially a password vault, right? So you've created a bunch of passwords.
Yep.
You store them in a vault, and then that vault, when you enter your master password, so still using a password, then releases the passwords that are stored in that vault and auto-fills them.
Right.
It's not a lot different than just saving them in your browser.
Exactly.
Right? So what Traitware does is it actually creates a mathematical representation of who you are on your mobile device as one part of the equation. We then take part of that mathematical equation and stick it on a separate authentication server.
Okay.
Those are split. They're encrypted. And so I can't go anywhere or sign into any service provider or any application until I authenticate to my app. And that then it authenticates to our authentication server to ensure that that mathematical representation that we created of you matches within an allowable percentage of change. So unique thing with what Traitware is as you use your device, and the way that you use your device is very unique to you, even from your own spouse, your child, doesn't matter who it is. It's so unique that our representation that we create of you separates you to 1 in 300 billion. That's how unique you are. Now, when it pings the authentication server, it looks for those trait characteristics, right? And again, this is a mathematical representation of you, not the personal information, right? So we're not putting any PII at risk. When the authentication server verifies that that mathematical equation matches within the allowable percentage of change, it then looks for the new changes and essentially is a dynamic token at that point. It then updates the key. So if you think of it in simple analog terms, at your home, you most likely have a front door lock and a deadbolt, right? Most digital resources that we sign into are only using the front door lock. Some of them have added the deadbolt, right? So now when I sign into my authentication server with that and then want to sign in, so I'm using my biometric to authenticate to the app. So that's something I am, right? Then my secure token is something I have. So now I have multi-factor, right? Which is the door lock and the deadbolt inherent in the technology, right? Then whatever service I want to sign into or can integrate with creates a, what we would term as a relying party trust to the authentication server, right? So it's separate from the phone, right? So this is another big thing with a lot of the other authenticator apps that are out there, is that when you self-register to use Google Authenticator or Authy or one of those other authenticator apps, it's storing just a what we would term as a shared secret only on your mobile device and creating the relationship between the mobile and the application directly, right? By separating it to our authentication server, if a bad actor gets something on your phone, they've only got one part of the equation. If a bad actor gets something on the authentication server, they've only got one part of the equation. So there's been incidences that you can review on your own terms, but that of those other systems being beaten because of the way to intercept that payload, right? So once we create the relying party trust from that service provider to the authentication server, you can't sign into something without it completing the loop from the phone through the server to the service provider.
Well, let's. I'm going to try to dive into the business a little bit to try to help some entrepreneurs out there. So as they start thinking about how they grew their business, what lessons we can learn from your journey. So at some point, you had a product, you decided that you needed to bring on a CEO, somebody with some marketing chops. Bert, what went into the decision? Walk me through that.
Well, a lot of factors go into that, but the thing of bringing Heath, I mean, I'm not a marketing guy. And you'd ask some questions on intellectual property. My view on intellectual property, it doesn't do you any good if you can't sell it to somebody or get somebody
great
to use
point.
It. I mean, what's the use of creating it? So I've always tried to create patents that were useful. So now we need somebody. So part of the process of thinking about that is you need somebody that can get the message across. And I think you've heard Heath talk,
yes.
And he can talk the message better than I can.
He knows it very, very well.
He knows it extremely well. But he's, you know, there's basic processes for business you've got to have. And one of the things Heath did, and I quit worrying about him actually earning an income when he was back in high school. And he started a business in high school selling stock reports off of CompuServe. And he created four business rules. One, you got to have the product. You got to sell the product. You got to deliver the product. And you got to collect.
Makes sense.
Those were his four business rules. So we needed somebody that can sell the product and collect on it at this point.
Well, okay, so what made you decide you're going after the enterprise space? What made you decide to go after enterprise? Because passwords are a hassle for everybody.
So
go ahead.
I'll answer that just in a simple term, is that the consumer play will come at some point. Because of the way that Traitware is built and the way that it needs to integrate to that service provider to create that relying party trust before you can sign into it, for security reasons, we have a barrier to entry to the consumer play because of the way that our technology integrates. There will come a tipping point, and we're available to consumers in certain environments now, depending on certain businesses that have deployed us, right? They can then empower their clients to use the Traitware technology to sign into their service, but it has to be integrated to that business before the consumer can choose it. Going back to that, you can't just self-register for it because of the way we built the security. So by default, we have to go business to business first. And maybe a simple way to understand it is when electronic bill pay first came out, they had to get enough businesses to sign up for consumers to choose it.
Yeah.
We have that same chicken or egg problem with that. We've also found that even though it's a major convenience thing, right? People, every consumer we show this to is like, sign me up now, right?
Yes.
Sign me up now.
Get rid of the sticky notes or
right.
Excel spreadsheets or
right.
Whatever.
Right, all of those things, right? And so we firmly believe that a certain tipping point of critical mass will happen where this will become consumer available. And also, as technology continues to improve, we're looking at innovative ways to empower the consumer to use this type of technology. But because of our foundational mantra and the way that we've things that we want it to be secure.
Mm-hmm.
So just we've chosen to not maybe go as quickly as some other ventures have gone to allow the consumer to use it, because we feel like that's going backwards in insecurity space from that. And so we are working to get there in a secure way.
So, yeah, thinking about enterprise security, we're all worried about getting our data stolen right now. It's a really hot issue. Cybersecurity in general is a hot issue. I mean, what are businesses worried about? Obviously, they don't want people hacking, but is there more liability today than there was 20 years ago?
So I think there's a bit more liability today as everything's gone digital, right? So the new currency or new assets in the space today is your digital profile, right? So much of what we do is integrated today, and that's only going to continue to compound with the IoT space and everything else that we do within that. So cybersecurity is something that every business needs to take seriously, and unfortunately, the small businesses and even the medium-sized businesses usually don't have the budget to take it seriously. And that's something that's hard to deal with, right? And so how do you address those kinds of things when you're just scrapping to get moving forward, right? And every SaaS app out there wants $5 to $10 a head to do it, right? And then a frustration we have, and we're hoping to make an impact on this at some point, is sadly, a lot of the SaaS apps out there require you to be on a higher level plan to use the security features, which we think is wrong, right? Security should be inherent in the basic plan, right? As an example, right? I don't know how much trouble I'll get in for throwing this out there under the bus, but so Gmail, right, as an example, is a free email service, right?
Right.
Username, password. You can use their Google Authenticator for free as part of that. To really get the enhanced features of security, you've got to step up to their business edition of G Suites, right? Paid subscription, right? Okay. So that's a simple example of that. So, you know, we definitely want to empower the small, medium-sized businesses to use cybersecurity in every way. Now, there's multiple facets to cybersecurity. There's back-end threat detection. There's firewalls. There's all the stuff that you need to do in your network and all of those things. However, the simple interface and the number one threat vector, according to everyone else's studies, I mean, even the most recent Verizon DBIR report in 2019, still astoundingly credits credentials as the number one issue, right? So
we're talking more than 60% typically on the order, 80% of cyber breaches are tied to username and credentials. And
wow. That measure is tied to credentials.
Can you get a sense, like when you're talking to one of your clients or prospects, I mean, do you have a sense as to the value you're adding by them taking on your product versus what they're doing today? Where do they find the savings besides the big threat?
Well, we just did a commercial project, and they had real security needs in this particular one, and they were using keys on tokens that they had to have 5 tokens for some of their people to sign in. They still had usernames and passwords they had to use. So it was cumbersome.
Yes.
Plus, so there was a cost.
Cumbersome for the admin team.
Cumbersome for the user, cumbersome for the admin, cumbersome for the individual. We literally came in there with Traitware with multi-factor app that could sign into all those accounts with the same level of security, and they were throwing their tokens across the floor.
So they had more time. They didn't have to mess with the tokens.
They love it.
So the simplicity of it, we reduce help desk tickets, right? So as an example, you know, password resets right now, whether it's from password policy, right? So inside of companies, whether you're small or big, someone's administering a password policy, right? That could be that you've got to change your password every 6 weeks, right? So you face downtime, potential lost productivity every time there's a password reset, all of those things. Going back to what I mentioned earlier, with ours being a dynamic token, the password reset's built into the technology. So the extra steps of security and not entering a one-time passcode is inherent in the technology in Traitware, right? So we reduce the friction for the user, and the average, you know, people say instantly, they come back with, well, what happens if you lose your phone, right?
well, then you got to reset your phone, right? You've got to be re-onboarded. But we can onboard a user in 2 steps, basically under 2 minutes.
Are people typically using their personal phone, or is it the business phone to do this?
So there's various cases in that. So in this recent enterprise deployment, we deployed to a company that provides software within the healthcare space, okay? It's a 3-phase deployment for them. The first phase was for their internal employees. And that same question came back, right? So they have a certain percentage of their employees that are on corporate devices, right? So then it's a no-brainer. You're using the corporate device. You use this on there. For those employees that were on personal devices, they had to give them a choice, right? Because you can't force someone to use a personal device for your work if they don't want to, right? If they don't want to add an right. extra app, they don't want to do that. So then we get the pushback on, well, then they've, you know, how do you solve that problem? Well, it's actually very simple. So if you are in a space that you really recognize or that you're being regulated to use multi-factor authentication, the only way to achieve multi-factor authentication is some other device. Whether it's a YubiKey or a CAC card or an RSA key, one of those other types of tokens has to be there, or another authenticator app. So if you look at the other authenticator apps, or one of those other tokens, you're back to either using a phone as a token mm-hmm. or one of those other tokens. We can prove that even if a user says, well, I don't want to use my personal phone, a company can buy an inexpensive Android phone for less than they can buy a YubiKey for right. or an RSA key for, and supply that person with a token that they can register for their work access for less money, and you don't have to buy a phone plan.
Right.
You can then actually just pair it and add more security by adding it only to your corporate Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
So it's a no-brainer, like cost savings wise.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have to, or you choose because you're being smart, and if you're not using some measure of MFA today, you better start now. Whether you use Traitware or not, You should be using multi-factor authentication on every account that you have, personal or business, period. You can't get by without it. Have to.
The number of stolen credentials is just astronomical.
It's in the billions.
3.3 billion was the report for last year of stolen credentials.
And what, like, I can see in the medical field why people would be so concerned. Are there other industries that are really ripe, you know, the low-hanging fruit?
So what we've seen recently, fintech space is low-hanging fruit. You know, we're working on some avenues in there. There is certain ways you have to approach the fintech space. But the other thing is, actually, I have a background in real estate, and I know that your daughter has a background mm-hmm. in real estate. So false wire transfers in the real estate space have been huge.
Yes,
right?
We've caught them.
Huge. So typically, the incidences that I know of, right, and I know of 3 that actually the brokerage and the agent were found liable in court for the loss. The reason they were found liable is because now this was, again, human error, right? But basically, email breach, right? So phishing, whatever it was, the bad actors took over the email address, make a duplicate copy of that, and then they send the false wire instructions milliseconds ahead of the real ones, right? Mm-hmm. And so the court actually found the agent, ultimately the broker, liable because they hadn't used best practices, right? Password policy or MFA on that particular email, right? So if you're not used as a small business, imagine being a 20-year-old that decides to get their real estate license, and now you accidentally make a mistake with your email, and you're on the hook for 7-figure yeah. losses.
Well, and a lot of people don't think about this until you get into the business world. So there are a lot of earlier stage entrepreneurs who are jumping in, and you know they're mainly worried about growing their company. But
right
now, if you're wire transferring money, you better be careful, right?
Right.
So obviously, Traitware is just working to solve that problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so thinking about this, one of the things you mentioned was intellectual property, right? So how to protect this. Why is that? Why does that matter so much?
Well, what you're basically selling in a software as a service company is a service, and you want to be able to protect those ideas. So that is you've got or intellectual property, whether you're getting a patent for those or whether it's a trade secret or whether it's a copyright that you've got, you need to be able to protect those things.
So somebody doesn't copy what you've done.
So like
and compete.
Don't copy it. So you can actually protect it in a way. One of the things that we have done is we have filed for patents. We started filing for patents back in 2012. I've been involved in industries for quite a while. I've been involved in several patent suits. Was involved with one. I used to work for a Fortune 500 company. We combined with a company in Europe to create a process in flue gas desulfurization. Ended up in a big patent battle. We kept other people out. I ended up starting another company called ECNC Technologies. It was also in the air pollution control field. Created a patent for that with a partner, and we were fortunate enough to be able to get claims that were valuable enough, could be protected, and stood up in court. We actually put two companies out of business. There are people that aren't happy with me, but I also kept people at work.
Yeah, kept your company
and
kept more
my
valuable.
Company at work. Kept income coming in for my family, some of which helped create Treeware.
Yeah,
so I'm going to speak to one more thing on that. Yeah. So with the IP and the filing patents and those kinds of things, not only can it potentially keep other people out, but a big side of this that a lot of people, including investors, whatever, don't really think about is it just also ensures that you can do business the way that you want to do business. There, everybody always comes back, well, okay, they only got to change it 5% or whatever, they can do their thing. Yes, they can. And it may not be as an efficient process. He's experienced this, right? So through his previous patents and other businesses, somebody else created a process that was similar, but it wasn't as efficient, meaning cost-wise, all deployment-wise, all of those things. So he ends up winning out. But what it does do, you know, we're playing in a global space, right, against global billion-dollar companies, right? But what it does do, if they do create something, because they're out there trying to create similar processes right now, some of them are very close. But what our IP does, at least the stuff that we filed patents for and have patent filings on, is it allows us to ensure that we can do our process. So if you can get to market and gain enough market share and nobody can shut you down, whether you shut somebody else down or not, may or may not actually mean what you your success.
Right.
Yeah,
if you can stay in business and go get your market share, that's a huge valid aspect of IP.
Yeah, let me explain that a little more. Because what happens in the process of filing a patent, to actually get it, you have to be able to show it's unique and innovative. And what happens is the patent examiners have the responsibility to go through and search all the patents out there, all the patent base, and also from their own experience, because typically a patent will be assigned to somebody that knows the space, and also the attorneys you're using sometimes will know the space. So you can be pretty sure, you can't, not 100% confident that you've always got everything covered, but you can be pretty sure that your technology stands up as unique, and you can be pretty sure that you've also moved it to the point where you know you're not infringing somebody else's stuff because of all the searching that has to go on. It doesn't totally eliminate that, but it helps tremendously in reducing that risk, because you don't want to go creating a new technology that somebody else has already got a patent on or created. It's gonna, you're going to get 5 years in and find out, oops,
that you get shut down.
So this is a U.S. patent. How does that affect it when your competition is overseas?
So let me explain a little bit on that too. The early patents that we filed at Treeware are strictly U.S. But all the most recent ones we've done, we will be filing those internationally. The patents I had in my previous company, we did go international with those. I actually put a company out of business in Italy, fought a patent suit in Italy, besides also fighting one here in the U.S. We first fought one here in the U.S. and then had to do one in Italy too. So some of the fundamental ones that we've now filed for and that I think have significant value, we will be filing those internationally. But you've got to grow your company enough to be able to support that, because when you go to the international field, it's really not a fair basis between, you get a patent in the U.S. for like, you're paying $4,000 for 3 years, and it covers 300,000 people. In Europe, you're paying $3,000 to $4,000 every year per country. Mm-hmm. So your cost overseas and other countries is tremendous.
So you really
compared
have to determine whether or not, you know, cost versus value, right, mm-hmm. on filing just in the U.S. or overseas, and what stage your business is, or what the propensity is for your technology or your solution, product, whatever it is, tangible asset product, is actually going to be global or not. And then you have to determine when to invest in that.
Well, you mentioned stage of company. So you guys have already started making sales. You've got the product developed. Obviously, it's still developing, but you guys are taking it to market now. Is that right?
We are taking it to market. So earlier in the conversation, I mentioned that when I first came on to the company, I kind of took it out to some of the enterprise space and got some feedback of, this is amazing tech, but you're on the bloody edge of it. Come back when you're kind of on the bleeding edge. And so we had to kind of identify, you know, where could we find some early adopters and everything. So about a year or so ago, we identified that the WordPress website content management platform was at that time and is still growing. It's over 30% of the websites in the world are built on WordPress, right? So they have a certain measure of risk, and they have a central market repository. So an easy way to distribute our product globally instantly. So we built in the WordPress space, it's called a plugin that anyone can install on their website, which then creates that relying party trust we talked about with our authentication server and allows that website to then use Traitware for the back end access or the front end access. And in doing that, we gained the attention of certain digital marketing agencies that were managing multiple websites and all of that stuff. And so we got adoption and growth and user base, which then allowed us to get back to the enterprise space. And so we got past that no one wants to go first stage. So we, you know, as we've now come back to that and could say, hey, we've got this many users that have been using it for 8 months. It works. It doesn't just break. And so we were able to then go win a recent, you know, as we said in the healthcare space, a substantial contract that over the three phases will be very substantial, and have gotten letters of intent from other companies recently that are now getting on board.
How did you discover the WordPress the plugin idea? Because that's obviously a great way to get the product out there. It's a low risk. It's easy to get on board, versus going and landing some big enterprise customer that's got, you know, a long sales cycle.
Well, you know, we kind of just looked around the landscape and said, how could we use this technology in a way that's efficient, right? And I'm not totally sure.
WordPress, okay, right. Great. WordPress.
Right, well, we kind of looked at where, I mean, we honestly did some due diligence on large markets with easy deployment.
Easy to say why we picked WordPress over some of the others, because WordPress was the dominant platform. Yeah. You got 30% of the internet websites in one fell swoop by creating one plugin for one particular niche. Now we're planning to expand that to other content management platforms down the road. But
because we basically just had to look at what is a simple, fast way to integrate to a large audience,
and it was something we were using.
One of the things we've done.
And one of Heath's business rules now for our company is that everything we use internally, we have to have multi-factor authentication, and we want Traitware on it. And we're literally telling people now, if you want us to use your services, you've got to set up the integrations to get that to happen. Because we were talking about the integrations, which really is a machine-to-machine interface. So that's part of the reason for the enterprise stuff, is to get that machine-to-machine set up.
I have a couple of investments that are software companies that I think might get some benefit out of talking to you guys. Yeah. But thinking about this, so you guys are an early stage company. You've begun to land some enterprise type clients, but you're also going to be pitching at Mark Tank. So I assume you're looking at raising money. Are you in the process of a raise of some kind? Can we talk about that?
Yeah, so we are currently in the process of raising money. We've recently made the switch from research and development to scaling now, right?
Yeah.
So our team has been very heavy on the engineering product development side, and we need to empower the sales cycle. We now have a proven deliverable solution. We displaced a very substantial incumbent provider and beat one of the other leading technologies for this recent deployment. And so now it's just a matter of executing, right? But to do that, unfortunately, it is a pay-to-play space, right? So whether it is getting in front of the right decision makers through a platform like Gartner or one of those things. The other, just exposure, right? Just the expense of exposure. We are doing the grassroots bootstrapping of everything needs to be done on a referral of a warm engagement through other business relationships that you have built, which is how we're getting to market currently, but to accelerate that scaling to ensure that we get to what we see as a minimum viable market share to make the business a success, we need to hit the gas pedal on sales and marketing.
So how do you look at that window? So you say this minimal viable market share by when? You're an early stage company. I need to get to 10 million by 2022, or how do you think of that?
So, I mean, we're thinking of it in numbers of users that then propagates to revenue from that. And, you know, a simple way we looked at it initially is just how many people have a smartphone in the U.S. today, right? And globally, right? Worldwide, right? So, 87% of the population has a biometrically enabled smartphone today. If we could get 10% of that market share, we're minimally viable, right?
Well, 10%, that would be fantastic.
More than minimally.
That's a few billion, right?
There are over 3 billion smartphones in the world. And,
right.
And we worked at the numbers and said, okay, if we get to 10% of that, we got 300 million users a month. If we get to 50 cents a month, we got 150 million a month in revenue. And now we're saying, really, to be viable, we need to make that 20%.
Yeah.
Of the market. So now we're talking 600 million.
Minimum.
Minimum 600 million users.
I'm just thinking out loud here is how long is that window, right? Because we know there are other people that are doing things differently, but they're in that same space and there are some people with deep pockets. How long do you have to get there?
I'd say within the last year, we probably have. And I'm not saying to get to the full 10% market, but to get to 3-4% of that to then get it to grow, we probably need to be there in the next 2 years.
Next couple of years. And so as part of that, so some of these companies are raising money, and especially in the software space, they're not as focused on bottom line. They're more focused on top line or users. I mean, how would you describe your focus? More on users, or is this the type of thing that you can continue to raise money against even if it's not cash flowing?
You can continue to raise money against it, and even though it's not cash flowing to a certain point, right? As long as you can show that at some point the hockey stick's going to happen, right? Or at least that there's an exit, right? So the moment you take money, right? So if this is going out to all of the young entrepreneurs or people trying to figure it out, you have to decide how you want to build your business, right? Are you going to bootstrap it to a point to where you can go get a loan and you maintain entire control over the whole process? Or are you competing in a space that's such a big space that you have to lever other people's assets, right? So the moment you make that decision to lever other people's assets, there's really only three scenarios that could happen, right? One is you get so big that your profit margins and your dividends are large enough to satisfy the money that you borrowed from those investors, which is probably the least likely of the three scenarios. The second scenario is an acquisition happens, right? Somebody acquires your technology to make it part of their environment or whatever else it is. Or third, you go all the way to IPO.
Yeah.
Right.
You didn't mention the fourth one that happens a lot. People go out of business.
I wondered if he was including that.
I was waiting for you to say failure, catastrophe.
Right.
It seems to me like failure.
Thing, you don't think failure. Yeah. You think positive.
I mean, I believe failure is not an option, but it seems these days, I don't know if you've heard this, Bert, or either one of you guys, Heath, it's like, oh, you know what? It was a great learning opportunity for me. And, I always get a little frustrated when I hear that.
No, that's frustrating. That's not quite where we wanted to go. And, you know, I got started on this, and partly it was to create jobs and never realizing I was creating a job for my son. But I have always thought of it in terms of you have to have a product that is eventually going to generate money. That's the measurement stick by which you're going by. Now, granted, numbers of users is critical for us, and creating mass of that is critical for us and getting those numbers up because – that's part of the viability for people who are looking forward to see us to actually start using it. It's also, we talked about earlier, getting to the tripping point that we can actually provide it for the individual customers so that you've got enough businesses that are already integrated and they can apply it, and you can go to your bank or you can go to your Walmart or Amazon or whoever you're signing into, and you can be able to use Tradeware.
Yeah.
So with that said, yeah. So, you know, failure is always a possibility in any scenario. Doesn't in life, right? Whatever your vision of, you could get in a car accident tomorrow, right? So failure is always something that's out there. It's not something we choose to focus on in any aspect of our lives, right? It's something we always focus on, you know, how do we do better? How do we help everybody else do better? How do we empower people to serve each other, right? With those things. But going back to the IP part of it is that we're like within our company, our technology and our solutions far enough along now that somebody most likely, depending on how you present it, would want to at least own what we've built so far at some measure, right?
Okay.
Because we've gotten to that tipping point where we've now commercially deployed it in the enterprise space. We've also got the WordPress plugin. We've got 2 patents issued. We've got 10 others filed, just so that they don't have to spend the 4 years of R&D that we have. They would buy it now for X number of dollars to move forward. So when we talk about exits, you know, we have this painted number of what we would like to see in an exit in comparable space to what other technologies have recently derived from their exit. But to at least maybe cover the investments and stuff, you could just go sell the technology.
So the most likely scenario really is some strategic or venture corporate VC coming in and wanting you to be part of their business.
Right. So there's, you know, and that there's multiple ways with our technology. We're definitely pursuing the right strategic alliances and strategic partnerships. There are so many different verticals that this technology applies to that whether it's fintech or healthcare, whatever, you know, real estate space, right? You know, we've been in conversation with big, you know, title companies, more, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera, in the real estate space to the healthcare space. So whether there's the right strategic alliance in that vertical, you can license it to them for that vertical, right?
Yes. Yes.
And then there's other verticals that it applies to. So it just depends on how you want to do that technology. I have a conversation tomorrow with a service provider. There's a lot of others, you know, something we haven't discussed yet, but the way our technology is built is there's other service providers out there that already have their own mobile apps, right? But they haven't figured out how to eliminate legacy login for that mobile app, right? Let alone use it for cross-platform or cross-device access. So as an example, there's some current fintech apps out there, whether it's PayPal or Chase Bank or Wells Fargo, as examples, that allow you to use your biometric in what I would term as a convenience factor, right? So some of those mobile apps now allow you to use your biometric on your mobile device to sign into just the app. I say it's a convenience factor because if your biometric doesn't work, they allow it to revert to the phone's master PIN, which is not really that secure, right? The other thing that they haven't done is bridged the gap of signing in just on your mobile device to a separate screen. You know, so much of the younger generation today is going to work directly on their mobile. I work directly on my mobile a lot of the time. But there's also a lot of the time when I want to work on a bigger screen, right? Or 2 screens, right? And so I need to sign into a desktop, a laptop, a TV screen, right? So we have that ability to do that. And we have the ability to take our technology and embed it in an existing mobile app, right? So I have a call tomorrow with a company that is in the alarm space. They've got an existing mobile app. Their users, they use the mobile app to turn on and off their alarm at their home or their business, right? They use it to sign into the control panel to configure their alarm system. That probably needs to be pretty secure. It's currently using just username and password, no option for MFA.
Right.
So, but because they already have an existing mobile app, we can embed it in their existing mobile app. Their user's experience is only going to be that they got an updated app and a new way to authenticate to their existing environment, no friction.
Okay, so we only have a little bit of time left, yep. And I want to make sure we get some nuggets away here for our entrepreneurs. So father, son, working together. How's that working out, working with pops, right? You've had this success in the past, built companies and sold them. Your dad's had a lot of success. There's a lot of testosterone in that office, I have to imagine. Okay, for each of you, how do you deal with that?
It's been interesting. It has been a switch for me, moving from being the boss, because he was working for me initially, to him being the boss. Yeah. And I've had to learn to step back, realize he's in control of stuff now, and let that go.
But how's that? I mean, is that difficult?
It's difficult in a way, but in other things, and I think every dad's dream is to have their son move up. You've got a son that's working for you. Yeah. Have them move up, take over for you. I never expected it to happen. I mean, he went a totally different path than I went. I went college, graduate school, big corporation, worked for Fortune Corporation. He goes totally the other way, ends up starting on his own companies, becomes a sea instructor, moves up.
Yeah, he's a free-spirited guy.
He's a free-spirited guy and got around. But as I said earlier, I could see the entrepreneur stuff all the way back in high school, quit worrying about him. I just never expected it to merge where we would be working together. And to me, it's just a amazing thing to have happen. But I'm willing to step back.
Yeah. Well, so my son calls me Mark around the office. I'm like, what do you call me Mark for? Just call me Dad. He wants to keep it business. I don't know. I heard you refer to your dad as Bert. Thoughts on that?
So yeah, I mean, there's times and place to keep everything professional, right? Yeah. And I'm going to throw the caveat in there that even though he he stepped sideways to being our CTO, right? So there's, and he alluded to this earlier, that in any business, there's really three main pillars of business, right? And I actually went through some training recently that really just that compiles this, but you need a product pillar, you need a marketing pillar, and you need a financial pillar, right? You need someone that's leading each one of those pillars, right? For a business to really be successful, you have to have a team of people, not one, right? And entrepreneurs typically land in two of those pillars, right? They're typically either a product guy or they're a marketing guy. If you see a CEO that was the CFO, it's because the other two screwed it up and the CFO had to take it over. But the CFO guy that it ends up being the CEO doesn't typically start there, just generally, right? I'm not saying that they don't exist, but that's the typical layout of that. With that said, coming into this company, I started out working, doing business development part-time for the company underneath him, right? Because I saw an opportunity. I have a sales background and just I done well at building relationships, right? And everything is, to me, has been done on how do you build a relationship? How do you maintain that relationship? And then how do you find a way to monetize that relationship the right way, right? And as that happened, my wife for a short period of time was like having a hallelujah moment because I've been self-employed, and what I term that is signing the front of the check for about 26 years, right? In seasonal businesses, other projects that were always like, we didn't know where the money was coming from next month, right? So when I got this paycheck job, right, she was like, "What? You're signing the back of the check?
What is this?"
Right. You're signing the back of the check, and I'm like, "Yeah, well, it's a paycheck from a startup. Like, we'll see where this goes." But
it's gonna get bigger. Don't worry.
Hopefully, right? That's the plan.
It's gonna get bigger.
It's gonna get bigger. So, and a lot of that paycheck was like, I saw, also having the entrepreneur bug, I saw the opportunity and said, well, I'll take as much of that as I can in stock shares, options, whatever else, because I'm betting on the come, right?
You believe in yourself.
I believe in that. Yeah, I'm putting it all back into making it go, right? So with that said, so I had this short window of time of signing the back of the check. And then as things progressed and realizing that as we take this product to market, part of it is just as we're raising money and taking it to market, recognizing that you need to put some energy in a face of the company that can stand behind that, right? Mm-hmm. So the board of directors decided that it was time, right? And it wasn't just his decision. We have a board, right? So the moment you also are running on private equity, you answer to other people. So as much as he says that I'm now the boss, I still, so in all of my other ventures of signing the front of the check, I only answered to my wife.
Right.
Or the customer. And that's also something no one ever thinks about, is that entrepreneurs do answer to other people. You have to answer to the customer, right? Or you don't make any money, right? So you are always working, whether you're self-employed or not, you are always working for someone else.
Well, you bring up, I think you bring up an interesting point. We've all heard about the WeWork scenario where you have this guy, Newman character, bigger than life, good sales guy.
Right.
He ends up doing, you know, he takes money from outside investors and all the way to the point where they're getting ready to go public, but his self-dealing and some of the things that he had done, I guess, to feather his own nest, really came back to bite him when they really opened the kimono. And so now, when you first took on your first dollar of investment, did you change practices at that point, or has it always been running by the book?
Pretty much by the book.
It's been run by the book. Yeah.
We've got a soundboard, and actually the decision to move Heath up was actually done by the chairman of our board more than me, and the chairman of our board comes out of two major corporations at a very high level. And to have a guy like him make the decision that your son is the guy to move up was pretty gratifying for me, too. I think it made it easier for me to accept. And it took the burden off of me moving my son up. That was an interesting aspect of it.
Well, Traitware, it's a great story. It's early stage. You'll be pitching at Mark Tank, and look forward. And I know we're taking a look at the possibility of maybe Mark Haney sneaking onto the cap table. So anyway, I appreciate you guys sharing your story for Sacramento, sharing the story for the region. I think this is how we learn. Today we got a little bit technical in a way, but I think we definitely, with this father-son thing, we brought the human aspect to what entrepreneurship can be.
Yeah, and we're open and reachable and approachable. So if there's entrepreneurs that listen to this that have a burning question, you know, reach out and we'll have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, you can email us.
And, you know, whatever questions that, you know, I've now built four different companies and had successful exits from three. So my track record's decent.
All right. But better than most, 750. But, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I've.